This is Maria Rosaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. She is a social worker who took a year off to explore her creative side and ended up writing a tale of magic realism set in Bondi. Robin Edwards' novel luxuriates in Bondi culture and uses waves as the key symbol. He is an established artist who explores the darker equation of the human condition in his startling abstract works. Joel Dickens grew up in the south of England, overlooking a coastline of moody grey seas, lapping waves, and very pebbly shores. Is there enough common ground to develop a conversation? You bet. Joel has known since he was a teenager that he's going to be an artist. I was excited at the prospect of interviewing someone with a visual art impetus. As I interviewed him, I realised he wasn't a beach person at all. He'd grown up with stony beaches in the south of England, which he admits reduced his new Australian bride to tears, distressed at the notion that such a thing could be called a beach. Maybe he had made a mistake. Was he going to be able to appreciate a novel which was virtually a tribute to Bondi? But in this, Joel rejoices. He catches Robin bringing the deeper and more disturbing elements of Bondi into the bright Australian sun. His own mother was a social worker, so he knows full well it just isn't the type of occupation that you can leave at the office. Homelessness, domestic violence, and soul searching all make their way into the sandcastles on Bondi Beach. Join these two diverse characters, find challenge and comfort in sunbaking on our seemingly sunny shores. Robin Edwards, hello and welcome to New Voices.
Hello, Maria.
Now, you and I have known each other, it's been about 3 years. We started off in the same writers group and we're both working on our first debut novels. And yours was beautiful. You have just finished it. Having seen it from its infancy, a really nice experience to be able to talk to you while it's still all fresh.
Like, some of my family are still reading it, but I think all my family were terrified I was going to write about them.
Nervous of being extra nice to you. A period of time you took off work.
That's true. I wrote every day for at least a year, maybe 1.5 years.
Put aside your career as a
social worker.
So what was it that made you go from serving people who are in need to serving this compulsion?
I had always wanted to write a novel. Mm. I'd been writing like since an adult, radio plays, short stories, poems, but I'd never written anything big and I'd never really had a concerted period of time, like a year. For me, it was a fantastic experience, a privilege to be able to be creative and to write and to think. The precious thing, time. Of course, I was writing about Bondi, which I love. So in a lot of ways, it was a labour of love.
You'd put this time aside. You know, this is going to be developing my creativity. How did it feel every day?
Some days I edited, some days I just wrote down ideas as well, but I made sure I did something every day. Mm. And often it entailed as well going for walks around Bondi, seeing interesting things.
Because that was your subject area. You knew from the beginning you were going to write about Bondi?
I knew. I always wanted to write about the ocean. You know, I've always been fascinated by books that explore a place. So I really wanted to push my own imagination and create characters. Mm. I didn't really have any big ideas about plots, narratives, just let this evolve and see what happens.
Was your first character, would you say, is Bondi?
Maria, I did see Bondi as a character, as a place, but then my characters, I almost said real characters, I thought, oh God. Whoops, fiction. So I tried to think, okay, what are some of the quintessential characters around Bondi? I didn't want to create stereotypes, but people who know Bondi would connect with straight away. So I thought, great, have an older male swimmer. So that, and then there was Dan, who was a young gay barista. And then I had Angela, and she was a personal trainer with a young family. I had them all connect with the ocean, and the start of the novel was a big rogue wave rolling in.
Like, if I follow that metaphor, it seems like this whole book, you know, kind of swelled up in you, and then you started to write.
It did.
Because I think one of the things we have to tell the listeners is that the style of the book is magic realism.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm wondering, did you start off with that idea or it became
It probably became that. I think at the beginning, I lacked a lot of confidence in my writing. And
oh, yeah, you're totally alone on that one.
Well, and the Rogue Wave was more just a way to start the novel in a dramatic way, bring my characters together. But then I developed this idea of different waves as metaphors. So I had the heat wave in part two, but then I had part three, which is really my favourite part. And that, I think by then I was more confident, decided to create a blue wave, other side of the Pacific at Easter Island,
yeah,
virtually on the same latitude as Sydney, that this rolled all the way across the Pacific. I tell people, look, if you haven't got time to read the whole novel, skip right through to part three.
You've got that beautiful luxuriating about beach life, and characters really do come to life.
I do really like, yeah, nearly all my characters.
Isn't it funny, that relationship you develop with the characters that, yeah. Did I manufacture them, or did they kind of like carve themselves out of me, yeah, out of my consciousness? I can imagine people who are from overseas, especially now in lockdown, low travel, to actually enjoy the Bondi beach experience, which is so famous, in a book.
I hope they do.
Yeah. But the other thing, big social conscience component. Mm-hmm. In your work. Did you plan that, or did that?
I didn't plan it. At the beginning, I thought, there's no way I'm going to write about social issues or social comment, or yeah, sort of had this purist idea, and yeah, I was going to leave terrible social problems behind. I wasn't going to think about them. I was just going to be on this creative high. I just kept writing, and also looking around Bondi, there's a lot of homeless people, and there always have been.
There's, still?
Yeah.
Real even estate? Now.
Yeah, people that are moving around, they come to Bondi. Some people are able to sleep at the back of the pavilion, the homeless centre in the heart of Bondi Beach. People that live rough, but also people that live, yeah, in cars, they travel up and down the coast. Jeannie's the character, I think, that you're talking, yeah, about. One of the reasons that I wanted to include a homeless person was to try to break down some of the stereotypes of homeless people.
Yeah, you certainly did that.
Good, thank you. This rogue wave, which connected my other three main characters, Raymond, Dan and Angela, it also connected
all those different strata of people.
Part of the narrative throughout the entire novel is about Jeannie and how she went missing after the big wave.
Exactly.
And what the hell happened to her.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, like I really enjoyed building her up as a character, and she became a lot more important than what I thought she was going to be.
But I want to ask you, when we're reading our material out to each other, when did you first feel you hit your writer's voice?
Look, I think I'm still finding my writer's voice, Maria, but I suppose for me it's about poetry, language, yeah, just words. The writer's group was invaluable, was very, very empowering, and it helped me a lot to finish the novel. Initially I thought, oh, you know, there's only going to be one novel, that's it. And with this having come out, I'd really love to write a sequel set in Bondi during the lockdown. I know Bondi really well, and I've lived there for such a long time. And for me, the most dramatic event that's happened in Bondi is the lockdown because of COVID.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, people were not allowed to go on the beach. Barbed wire was erected. There was a police presence. People were literally not allowed to go in the ocean.
That's a shocking thing.
Yeah, it was massive. I actually want to write a darker novel. Sort of uncovers some darker parts of me, maybe, and also some darker parts of Bondi.
Bondi, magic realism, social conscience, gorgeous language. How could it go wrong?
Thanks for that, Maria. I thought I'd read the section Call Heat. It's the beginning of part two. Locals woke early on New Year's Day, skin prickling and popping with sweat, bodies clammy, knowing the heat was building. By mid-morning, it was crackling. By noon, it was out of control. Only 2 months after the rogue wave, a second wave hit Bondi, a heat wave. The Bondi basin, covered in steamy heat, became a pressure cooker for 6 weeks. The neighbourhood simmered under a boiling red sun that grew fatter each day. Heat waves always produce the best crimes, and no one knew when this one was going to break. Unlike Sydney's western suburbs that swelter through this season, Bondi's summer is usually cooled and tempered by sweet nor'easterly sea breezes. But fierce winds had been blowing from the west, from far away in a desert, hot and dry and fiery red. The winds hit Bondi and the mercury began to climb. like a cake rising too fast, bursting at the seams, burning its crust. Before long, the temperature hit 40 degrees and kept going up, stoking fraying tempers. Some locals, still nursing hangovers from New Year's Eve celebrations, gave in to the heat and retreated to the coolest rooms in their homes, thinking the heat wave would break after a couple of days. Bondi locals without homes shared stories and ciggies, discarded layers of clothing and found bits of shade under motionless plane trees at the entrance to the beach pad. Languid couples on the beach lay exposed to the bare sky, boobs popping out of scanty bikini tops, balls bulging from budgie smugglers, tanned legs entangled between flesh, sand and sweat, the tip of a finger tracing lips, the thumb marking a smile, leaving its print, the hand slipping down a neck, circling a nipple, finding desire. All the while, the skin of bodies glistened. On Campbell Parade, Bondi's ice creameries turned their refrigeration up and up again to satisfy long queues of hot customers. Buckets of ice were thrown over fresh fish at the one that got away. The Icebergs Club did a roaring trade in cold Aussie beers. No one went thirsty. A languid Bondi lived through the heat wave, which slowed the beachside suburb to a limp. But there was always movement at Bondi, children doing cartwheels on the sand, teenagers flipping and falling on the skate ramp, women's saris catching the smallest of afternoon sea breezes, billowing their soft colours into the sky, dogs wagging their tails as they raced up and down the promenade, walkers on the shoreline marking sunrise and sunset. Raymond swims the bay solo. The lukewarm midsummer ocean temp is about 22 degrees, and mid-morning the sun sits on his back as he kicks and strokes across the surface of the Pacific. He breathes relief at being in the salt water, sinks inside it and slows his pace in response to the day's relentless heat. Through goggles he sees shiny, blue-spotted fish finning below, watches them pick up speed and then jump clear out of the water. Raymond's heart leaps in sync with this spectacle. On days like this, Raymond feels the longing deep in the ocean. He feels it deep inside his body too during these long swims. It's visceral. He has no words for it. "If only my family relationships could be as easy as swimming the bay," he mutters to himself, grimacing as he reaches the iceberg's rocks and then clambers up the steps to join his berg's mates. Remembering how the night before Lexi had been at him again to sort things out with his daughter Paula, but he doesn't have the words for that either. Dan is waiting out the heat wave, treading water. The westerly wind has ruined the surf, flattened it, making it look fake, the ocean flat like a desert landscape. Dan hunkers down at home behind blinds and in front of screens, reluctantly does his shifts at break, spends nights at the Beach Road Hotel with Luca, drinking beer and playing pool. A terrible dull boredom grips Dan on these days. He lives for the motion of waves. He wants that moment of flying down the crest or being barreled in a glassy tube. On days when the surf is without life, Dan thinks of the rogue wave and remembers the adrenaline crashing through his body. He misses that feeling, something he can't name. He's in awe of the two crack surfers credited with catching the rogue, though there was debate among professional surfers whether that wave could have been caught. Raymond told Dan the wave was wild at its core, that it would have shrugged off any fool trying to run with it. After his shift today, they'll meet at break for coffee. Angela's body shivers through the Bondi heat wave. She's in the garden drinking ice lemon tea made by the housing activists, Anu and Jai. They're talking about the transformation of shelter again. She doesn't say anything but is content to listen and try to find some meaning in their words, which seem foreign and strange to her, even though she knows well enough about the crippling cost of housing from arguments with her husband about their mortgage. "If only I could just pop down to the beach the way I used to and cool off with a quick dip," Angela thinks. But she hasn't been in the ocean she once loved since the day of the rogue wave. Angela, gripped by fear since the day she nearly drowned, has sworn she will never go back in. She relives the terrible shock of waking up in a hospital bed with her husband Matthew telling her in cold tones she had nearly died. Angela despairs that she will never get over that day. It was like in a violent marriage, how love can turn to fear overnight. This heat wave is all on the outside, Angela thinks. In the weather reports, Matthew's complaints, the children whinging, a whirring ceiling fan, my cool sarong and bare feet. But it's deep inside her that she feels waves of discomfort. Sometimes she has so much heat of a different kind churning through her body, she wants to throw up. Her refuge is the garden. Angela is happy to sit there during a whole morning, listening to the dreams and hopes and laughter of young people, then retreat inside her flat for the afternoon. During 6 weeks of heat waves, locals stop arguing about the rogue and where it came from and how high it was and why it came alone. Now it's all about the damned heat and when it's going to break. Locals think about the two waves coming from opposite directions. The first from the east, the second from the west, one from the ocean, the other the land. But the two waves have something in common, a mystery that ties them together. The rogue wave unearths Jeannie's lunchbox, a souvenir of the city's crime. The heat wave brings an understanding of what the crime is.
And now to our critiquer, Joel Dickens. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you, Dickens.
And we've just been listening to Robin Edwards.
First off, it's very intriguing. I thought that the description of Bondi, the way it was kind of set up in the beginning, was very poetic, and Robin is a poet as well. The way it was described was in a character in itself. But I was wondering there would be those cliches and stereotypes of creeping in, and I found it quite intriguing when the characters were introduced, and they were introduced in a very in a play-like kind of way. I felt like it was characters entering the stage in a sense.
Good way of describing it. She's sort of like introing them.
Yeah, kind of set and stage. And because, well, you had Raymond, the older swimmer who's lived in Bondi for ages. As they were introduced, as it went on, the characters got darker. That was set up very well. I thought at first that kind of listing of the character, the way each character got a bit darker and darker, is the side of things that I'm interested in. It left you wanting to know more.
Yeah, so. I'm intrigued by your impressions. Well, you're an artist, so you come from a totally different field. She has an occupation, and she has carved this time out to be able to explore that creative side, whereas creativity is basically your bread and butter. So how do you feel about people who take excursions into a creative life when it's your...
I think it's okay. I think what was interesting about Robin is that she does come from a social work background. Yeah. It was interesting to me that she's pressed pause on that a little bit to delve more into her creative side. And in that way, we are, I guess, at opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
It's like I've been painting for as long as I can remember, and jobs have always just fitted in around painting for your bread and butter, your day job. Very, very different approach. I would think that taking time off, taking a year off or 2 years off, for me, it sounds like a dream. In another way, I think it would be quite stressful as well. If that time was finite, I would think that as that time kind of ebbs away, it's a deadline, basically.
Yeah. Tell me about your art, because you were saying you were more interested in the dark side, and Robin was saying that she was going to take an excursion into that darker element of writing.
I think that was interesting.
I've seen some of your painting. They're chaotic, there's passion, there's colour. They do tend, the ones that I've seen anyway, towards that dark side. Do you want to give a description of how that works for you? Because I've got a dozen questions, like being in Australia, for instance, since you're obviously not born in Australia, and how that influences you. And
I think with my work, I mean, it's purely abstract for a start. In terms of its aesthetic, its style, it's what you might call gestural minimalism, which is a sort of contradiction in terms, really. But I tend to take a spontaneous gesture or scribble, a doodle, something that is seemingly sort of absent-minded or kind of emotional and spontaneous.
Not deliberate.
And then feed it through a creative process that compresses and slows down that movement. I do a lot of stenciling rather than using a paintbrush to quickly kind of create gestures.
Mm.
I'll follow the line of a gesture, but I will, in short, it's a very long, laborious, rather neurotic exercise. And the paintings take way too long to produce.
Do you love it, though, when you're in the middle of it? Like, or does it feel like a mess and you're in a jungle and you have to find your way out?
I love exploring the ideas and I love kind of problem solving.
Yeah.
I have painted more expressively in the past. If I were to say I loved painting then, I felt like it was a bit too indulgent. And so I've kind of layered the process to create a bit of distance between that immediate emotional response to the environment or to a relationship or to politics or what have you, and slow it down to compress it, to make it into something less indulgent.
Yeah, I kind of see a parallel there with Robin, because Robin, you know, she takes the waves and she takes it as a metaphor and she takes it physically, which are quick, comes and it goes.
Yeah.
And she's elongating it, weaving it into this story of people's lives.
Yes.
And the impact of the waves on these people. They're living within it, compressed and intensified.
Yeah.
And it's taken her into deeper places she would go,
which
is what I hear from a lot of writers. You know, they sit down and they say, I'm going to write this, and something totally different comes out. Is that why you choose something like a doodle?
I think.
And is it your doodle or is it somebody else's doodle?
I think it's my doodle, yes, yeah. Although I do have three young children, so there's no lack of sort of inspiration and source material. They are my doodles. I think that the difference maybe between writing and my painting, I know a lot of abstract expressionist painters will work in that way, that you don't necessarily know where you're going to end up. The difficult bit is knowing when to stop and when a paint is resolved. I do work in a way where I have a sort of image in mind. Once that initial motif, that initial gesture has been put down, it's more about working with colour and composition to achieve the image that is in my mind. I was interested to hear that Robin didn't know where the novel was going to go.
And I
think that's kind of frightening. It's, what is similar is that there is a device that Robin is using. So there might be that kind of uncertainty as to what direction these characters are going to go in. But the device of the three different waves, it might act as a scaffolding to the narrative.
It's so fascinating to me that you paint as a day job and then you've got this unexplored area of creativity, which is quite different. Or is it different?
It is different.
Different parts of your mind? Or is it the same place but expressed differently?
Well, maybe the same place but expressed differently. The kind of books that I read are always about the human condition, what it is to be alive, how terrifying it is. That's what I want to explore in both my painting and my writing. So in terms of the point of departure, it's kind of similar.
Right.
With painting, they're sort of one-off statements. It's almost like each one is a line in a book or in a poem or in a song, trying to create an image that encapsulates that. Whereas I feel that with writing, there's almost more freedom. You can create in a novel that kind of light and shade, which can say so many different things at once.
Is there ever any relationship between what you're painting and what you're writing?
They're both about the individual trying to navigate everyday life. Both with my writing and with my painting, there is a micro and a macro kind of element to them. With my painting, I want to sometimes disclose, you know, maybe a personal scene or scenario. But if you pull back from it, then there is a universal relevance as well.
What about the fact that you are so confident and you are completely out there with your painting? I don't know what's going on in your heart when you're watching people going around and examining your paintings and chats about them. Very nerve-wracking to me. But you're very shy about your writing. And I believe you don't show many people. Like
I don't show anyone my writing, really. No.
So explain that psychology.
I am afraid of showing my paintings. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Is it because a painting is up there and a lot of eyes are landing on it, whereas a book is something that you give to one other pair of eyes?
There's something a little bit more secretive, I suppose, about writing. And also because painting is my career, it's a system. So I paint, I exhibit, I paint, I exhibit. And it is always nerve-wracking. It's always frightening.
Mm.
With writing, it's even more personal,
even
more difficult.
More personal than your art.
Mm.
Can you put words around that? It's blushing.
You always draw on uncertain scenes and scenarios and characters, I suppose. Yeah. I do.
So what is it that you write?
A novel.
Yeah.
I'm happier showing people poems.
Robin has told me that one of the things that her family feared was that they were going to be put in the novel.
Right, yes. Yeah, I say I've never shown my writing to anyone, but sometimes my wife does open up my phone and there it is on notes and I've written something down and she says, Joe, you can't...
you can't say that.
You can't use that. And I say, no, it's not you. Honestly, it's not you.
What Robin writes about is something that she loves, which is water. Does the Australian landscape influence you at all?
I'm not really a beachy person. I love it and I love looking at it and I love going down there and I'll spend, you know, 15 minutes. I find myself kind of in awe of the Australian landscape. It's completely and utterly different, obviously, to the English landscape or UK landscape. So Kate almost cried when she saw an English beach for the first time. She said, this is cruel.
So why would you do this to water and land coming together?
So,
What about that scene that she drafted up with balls bulging and the boobs
Well, that would be interesting to read more because some of that more graphic, punchy kind of descriptive language.
It was so sensual.
Yes,
you know?
I wonder how it will pan out because there was a sort of hint of when she said most crime is committed in heat waves. It felt a bit kind of lockdowny, even though Robin wants to go on to write a book about the lockdown. Yeah. The fact that people were indoors, the heat was outside, the streets were cleared because it was so hot.
It was a lockdown of heat.
So in a sense, no wonder.
So I think you're right. There is that feeling of people just sort of scattering, getting away from the heat. And it is interesting to sort of see this pre-COVID, post-COVID feeling. And how's that going to affect your art?
Because I called my last show Insanitizer. It was painted at the end of July, sort of in the midst of it. And it was intended to try and convey that sense of unease and discombobulation and frustration and chaos that we were all kind of feeling at the time. It inspired the show in that way. In terms of selling paintings, career, it's very, very difficult for galleries. Galleries were closed down. It had a massive impact. I'm the sort of artist who paints exhibit in a gallery in a fairly traditional sense because people are ordering things online. But it's a different field, really, in a way.
Yeah. There's a lot of colour in your painting, very abrupt. There's a lot of abrupt lines. Did that translate well online for you?
No, it translates terribly. And that's... So I think all people should see all art before they commit to it, really.
Just listening to some of Robin's work, how do you interpret it as an artist? If that was a doodle, how would you explore that?
I think it has an almost apocalyptic feel to it.
I don't know
if that's the way the book is going to go, but that's the way I kind of felt it was going to go. And colour would be very important. Representation of heat, mate.
I hear her writing. As you were saying, it's poetic, it's lyrical.
There is a sense
of the ominous all the time.
I think it's interesting that Robin comes from social work and you can't. My mother was a social worker. You bring that stuff home with you. I think in the beginning, Robin was saying how she wanted to escape from that and that the book also was going to be the magical realism element. Thought it was going to be quite escapist in a way. But I think that if you work in a field like that, you can't really help but that to kind of creep into whatever you're creating, which I think is a good thing.
Absolutely. Mm. So tell me a little bit about your background, Joel.
I was born in London. I studied in the Lake District, fine art. I moved back to London, working and exhibiting.
You knew right from the beginning, always going to be art?
Made that choice probably at the age of around 15.
But your parents were okay with it? They didn't?
My mum has been number one ardent fan my whole life. So my sister and I were brought by my mum. My mum's a bit of a hero of mine, really, you know.
Yeah.
And being a social worker for many, many years and, you know, just instilled in us some values that I think were really important.
Yeah, and one of them being, I suppose, that you follow that passion that is going to make your life come alive.
Absolutely. Time is the only constraint, really. I appreciate having busy, sort of chaotic life in a sense because that's sort of what my writing and painting is about. I think I'm just immersed in it and I don't try to escape. I try to harness it and express it, both in painting and writing.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Joel, for coming in
Thanks very much, Maria. I'm looking forward to the really dark side.
I'll let her know that. This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program. Produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH, I look forward to your company next time.